Number 55, United States Petitioner versus Bert N. Adams et al. Mr. Douglas.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case is here on certiorari to the Court of Claims. The complaint charged the United States with having infringed the Adams battery patent held by the respondents. A commissioner of the Court of Claims, after an evidentiary hearing, issued proposed findings and conclusions, holding that the patent was valid and that some batteries of the United States had infringed that patent. The full Court of Claims, in a brief one-paragraph per curiam opinion, adopted all of the findings and conclusions of its commissioner on these two points. The government sought certiorari on only one aspect of the case. It left unchallenged that part of the decision below, holding that there had been infringement if the patent were valid. We brought to this court only the question whether the Adams patent was a valid patent. The basic principles involved in batteries of this general type are fairly easy to grasp. What's involved in this type of battery are three elements: two electrodes and an electrolyte. The electrodes are metallic strips or cylinders or rods. The electrolyte is a liquid solution. And the electrodes are suspended in this liquid solution. And if the electrodes have a sufficiently different electromotor force, then small particles of matter known as ions will move from the positive electrode to the negative electrode. And that movement will take place through the liquid solution in which the two electrodes are inserted. And the electrical charge can be recorded and measured by attaching wires to the terminals of the electrodes. The lower court found that the Adams invention consisted of a combination of electrodes and a combination of electrodes only. This is set forth, we believe, in finding 12, the commissioner's proposed finding, which was subsequently adopted by the full court. And as set forth in those findings, what the Adams invention purported to teach was an anode, which is the positive electrode, composed of magnesium, and a cathode, which is the negative electrode, composed primarily of a copper salt known as cuprous chloride. The court did not hold that the invention consisted of a combination of these electrodes with any particular electrolyte. Now this brings us to the statutory standards of utility, novelty, and non-obviousness. We concede that the Adams patent was useful. We raise no contention on that point. We contend, however, that it meets neither the test of novelty nor the test of obviousness as set forth by the Congress in sections 102 and 103. So far as novelty is concerned, we believe that Scrivenoff, a British patent English issued in 1880, is dispositive. It was a combination patent. It was not a carbon copy of Adams. Adams was not a carbon copy of it in all respects. But in our view, the differences are sufficiently minor and trivial that the two are, for all intents and purposes, the same. Scrivenoff called for a magnesium anode. Adams called for the same. Scrivenoff called for a cathode composed of cuprous chloride. Adams called for a cathode composed of cuprous chloride.
That was in that anode?
No, I'm going to continue, Mr. Justice White. In addition, Scrivenoff called for the addition to cuprous chloride of carbon. Adams called for the addition of carbon to the cuprous chloride cathode. And finally, Scrivenoff, however, did add other materials to carbon and to the cuprous chloride. But in each, Cooper's chloride was the primary element in the cathode. And there was no finding, indeed no showing, that this omission from Adams of these extra elements in Skrivenoff was significant. The court sought to distinguish Skrivenoff on the basis of its non-operability. And there was testimony to that effect, and the court found that it was inoperable. Accepting that finding, we would say that operability in itself does not establish the novelty of a present invention over a prior art, or an element in that art. Because operability can stem from a number of different changes. It might have stemmed from pure materials, from a different type of container, or from a larger electrode. And there's no inherent reason why operability should stem from a patentable change. In this case, there were no findings that the operability of atoms was caused by the differences between the Skrivenoff and Adams cathode. And only if a cause and effect can be shown between the differences in the two cathodes, in our view, can the differences, which are minor on their face, be shown to be significant. Indeed, the record suggests that Skrivenoff did not work because of the nature of the electrolyte it employed. There was testimony that the electrolyte in Skrivenoff was too strong, and that had water been used, the battery probably would have worked. There was no finding to this effect. We're not resting our case on novelty on this point. What I'm merely saying is that unless there's some finding that a difference in operability stems from a difference in the makeup of the two patents, then there's no basis for distinguishing the prior art for reasons of novelty. And of course, Your Honors, it is true that a presumption of validity normally attaches to a patent when issued by the patent office. No such presumption, in our view, should attach here. The file wrapper in this case, which discloses the proceedings in the patent office, is Trial Exhibit 11. Unfortunately, we did not include that in the printed record. It is a part of the original record filed with the clerk, and the parties have stipulated that it can be referred to and cited by the parties. But an examination of that file wrapper indicates no mention of the Skrivenoff patent. And since the most important element in the prior art, at least in our view, was not mentioned, it's difficult to see how the patent should be assumed to be valid merely because of its issuance. At a minimum, it suggests that no presumption of validity should attach so far as Skrivenoff is concerned. This brings us to the requirement that a patent not be obvious to a person skilled in the art. Of course, if a patent is found to be old, that's the end of it. Can't be valid. If it's new, it must still get over the test of non-obviousness. Here, the commissioner and the court found that each of the individual components comprising the Adams invention was known and had long been known in the art. And the respondents have frankly conceded in their brief that this was so. As a matter of fact, the court below found that each of the individual elements had been available for 50 years. Magnesium's use as an electrode had been anticipated by four sources. Cuprous chloride had been anticipated by three. So that the question in terms of obviousness is whether or not the combination of these individually known electrodes can be said not to have been obvious to a person skilled in the art. And I would suggest that on its face, an argument to this effect cannot be maintained. An electrode does not exist in a vacuum. It does not generate electricity by itself. It generates electricity only in combination with another electrode. When you're composing a battery of this type, you're looking for possible combinations of electrodes. And you're looking for a difference in the electromotor force. If you've used magnesium in a battery, You know, in general, what its electromotive force is in relation to other elements. Same thing is true if you have used cuprous chloride. So anyone, in our view, who knew that magnesium and cuprous chloride had been individually used as electrodes would have occurred to him to at least try combining the two and discover whether or not a practical battery could be developed. And it isn't a matter of just abstract reasoning. There are suggestions, or at least strong hints, in the prior literature and the prior patents that a combination to this effect was feasible. The Codd treatise in 1929 called for a magnesium anode and a copper electrode, copper cathode. Jumeau, which is a patent 1934, called for the union of magnesium on the one hand and lead chloride on the other. If one looks at the electromotor rating contained in Codd, which describes the various elements in terms of their rating, whether they're positive or negative, one would see that lead and copper are very close, just as one would see that magnesium comes near the top of the scale and chlorine comes near the bottom of the scale. And the important thing in an electrode, or one of the important things in choosing an electrode, is to choose one where there is a substantial difference between the two electrodes to be employed in the battery itself. And finally, so far as obviousness is concerned, Skrivenoff, even if it didn't completely anticipate the Adams battery, surely suggested the possibility of combining magnesium and copper chloride. It is true that there are other elements not present in Adams, but the possibility of omitting some of these other elements would not have been difficult. Indeed, would have been the most natural thing in the world for someone skilled in the art to consider. So what we have, in our view, is a selection of known battery elements from a known and finite list of possible components in a battery of known design with no change in the respective functions of the elements, that is to say, the electrodes comprising the invention. Now, the court and the respondents seek to avoid what we consider to be the obvious thrust of the prior art by pointing to some unique characteristics and results found by the court to have been developed by the Adams battery. These findings are set forth in the court's finding 23. And they are two in number: a constant current, sometimes referred to as a linear potential, and the ability to operate under low temperatures. And on this basis, the respondents in the lower court contend that the requirement of non-obviousness was satisfied. But this approach, in our view, misconceives the basic nature of the obviousness test.
Which findings are these, respondents?
The findings of the court on the contributions of Adams of a unique nature, I believe, are finding 22 and 23. Page 704 of the printed record.
Page 31 and 32 of your petition for certiorari.
This approach, Your Honors, in our view, doesn't do justice to the standard laid down by the Congress in Section 103. What Congress wanted in that section was a comparison between the alleged teachings of the patent and the claims in the patent and the prior art. And one looks to secondary evidence, such as results or commercial success, only where the evidence in the prior art is ambiguous. Only if there is some kind of equivocation in the prior art. When there is no ambiguity, when the prior art is clear in terms of obviousness, then one may look at these secondary elements. It's a sort of best evidence rule which the courts have developed that makes a great deal of sense, because what the Congress was seeking to protect in accordance with the constitutional provisions was the enhancement of scientific advances and the encouragement of the same. Here, the obviousness, in our view, is so strong that you don't look for outside elements, for outside matters such as commercial success or new results. And I might say that even if, and we would dispute this most vigorously, but even if this were said to be a close question in terms of the prior art, the new results asserted here would not have established patentability. There were no findings in this court of a long search for these particular qualities. It's true that there was a statement that the individual elements had been available for 50 years. That doesn't establish a long search. It's true that the court found that there was a long-standing need. That in itself doesn't establish a search. There may be any number of reasons why scientists devote their attention to one thing rather than to another. Priorities, problems with the prior art. The point is, what we're looking at is whether or not someone did in fact search for these qualities for a long time, and there's no finding in the court's record that this was so. That being so, the long-felt need referred to by the court would not have been important even if this were a close question on the prior art. We don't believe that it was a close question. So the respondents seem to be saying, in our view, that the standard of invention is met if new results are achieved. But this court has said as far back as in Knapp against Moores, 150 U.S. 221, that one can't get a patent on new results. Patents are given on devices, on processes, on embodiments. But they're not given on results any more than they're given on ideas.
Do you think the other side of the coin is equally balanced, that if there's not a new result, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not invention?
I would agree with that.
You think the newness or lack of it of the result is basically irrelevant to the quality of invention?
Yes, I do. I would say that it comes into play only when the prior art is equivocal and ambiguous. So, in conclusion, Your Honors, I would suggest the two basic elements in the decision of the lower court present this court with significant and important questions which should be resolved. The first is, according to the lower court, that operability will distinguish one patent from its prior reference. We disagree with that. We think there has to be a finding that the operability, in fact, stemmed from a difference between the two patents themselves. The second error which the lower court committed was that it seemed to be concluding that new results in and of themselves were sufficient to get over the test of non-obviousness set forth in Section 103. And I think it important in preserving the delicate balance which this court has long monitored between competitive enterprise on the one hand and patent monopoly on the other, that these two doctrines be made clear that they're not applicable.
What was the patented item here? What was the claim? Was there anything in the electrolyte that was used, or was it just the use of cuprous chloride and magnesium? Is that all there is?
The claims themselves, Mr. White, included a reference to electrolyte, but the lower court found that the essence of the invention consisted of claims 1 and 10. And there's a statement in the opinion to the same effect on the record 646. There was no mention of the electrolyte in the specifications, which are quoted in the court's findings, and accordingly, taking the court's findings, we contend that the invention has been confined to a combination of the electrodes. Now, I can understand quite
aside from the electrolyte or anything else.
Quite aside from the electrolyte. I would say that I think I could understand why the court didn't reach the conclusion that the electrolyte was part of the invention. There was substantial prior art on the electrolyte. Jumeau had an electrolyte in 1934 of a similar nature. That's at record 572. Nioday, who was a treatise writer, had a water electrolyte suggested. That's at record 505. And accordingly, I think that may have been the reason why the court did not find the electrolyte to be part of the invention. The significant fact is they did so find.
Mr. Riley?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please this court. As my brother Douglas has said, the claims of the patent that are involved in suit are the entire 11, and we have relied primarily upon claims 1 and 10 as being exemplary. Claim 1 of the Adams patent reads, a battery comprising a liquid container, a magnesium electropositive electrode inside the container and having an exterior terminal, a fused cuprous chloride electronegative electrode, and a terminal connected with said electronegative electrode. Claim 10 calls, in a battery, the combination of a magnesium electropositive electrode and an electronegative electrode comprising cuprous chloride fused with a carbon catalytic agent. These elements had all been available in the art for more than 50 years prior to Adams' advent on the scene. Magnesium was isolated in 1854, became commercially available in 1870, was suggested by Scrivenoff in 1888. Cuprous chloride came into the art about the same time and was mentioned by Scrivenoff if protochloride of copper means cuprous chloride, as the government contends. In the Scrivenoff in the Scrivenoff disclosure, which Mr. Justice White asked a question about, we had a cathode which comprised carbon or copper faced with a paste of phosphoric acid, amorphous phosphorus, metallic copper, and cuprous chloride, mixed together with sulfuric acid and applied hot to the carbon and covered with blotting paper impregnated with zinc chloride and sulfuric acid. And when our expert put that together with the pure materials that he had available in 1960, and I don't know that the materials in 1888 were any purer, he had two fires. That was the use of cuprous chloride. I asked the government's expert when he testified as to Scrivenoff whether when the mixture of the cathode was put together, did it still contain cuprous chloride? And he said, I don't know. All I have is the information contained in the patent, and beyond that, I have no information whatsoever. Following that, our expert attempted to put the entire Scrivenoff battery together, including the magnesium anode and the electrolyte specified in Scrivenoff. And he had an explosion which blew out the vent of his laboratory, which is the device for exhausting air. And at that point, he stopped working on Scrivenoff. Now, the interesting thing about this battery, and I would really like to show it to you, I've taken the trouble or the effort here of putting together the parts of it because it's so very simple. This is a piece of magnesium which I have bent over. It started out like this, it's now bent this way. And this is a cuprous chloride electrode which has been combined with a bit of carbon. And it takes about 5 minutes to make it. You take a piece of copper screening, such as you use for mosquito netting, and you draw it through a crucible of cuprous chloride, and you get this sort of plating out on the wire. And I've connected the two electrodes together to a bulb. And I might say that I'm going to put this together using the method taught by Alessandro Volta in 1880. Beg pardon. I hope not. But this is a very, very simple thing. You just take a piece of Kleenex and wrap it around the cathode so as to prevent a short circuit between the cathode and the anode.
And then you put the cathode inside the anode. And hopefully, it'll work. Now, actually, since 1800, everyone has known that this combination really can't work. Batteries were invented by the great Italian scientist Alessandro Volta in 1800. And at that time, he determined, by a very simple experiment, he used a sheet of silver, a piece of silver, and a piece of copper. Between them, he put a little piece of cardboard. And he took that battery and soaked it in water. First water-activated battery. And the first one that didn't work. And he immediately determined that since it didn't work, he had to add substances such as salts or basic materials or acids to the water in order to produce the ions that my brother Douglas has mentioned, so that electricity can be conducted by the water. Pure water is an insulator. It will not conduct electricity. Magnesium is insoluble in water. So is Cooper's chloride. So is Cooper's chloride with carbon, insoluble in water. So when you put the two substances into water, neither one can dissolve in the water. You can't get a chemical reaction to form a conductive electrolyte. And the water remaining can conduct electricity. So on the basis of conventional voltaic theory, this battery cannot operate. And that's the very good reason why nobody bothered to put these things together. As the expert at the trial testified, in 1939 it was ridiculous for atoms to take two insoluble substances like magnesium and Cooper's chloride and put them in an insulator like water and expect to have a battery. Now, if I have some water, would you pour some of the water in there, please? The water is difficult. Now, specifically, the government's position is that the battery is not new, it is useful, and it's obvious. There is a very short answer to this, and the answer is this. If the components of atoms had been put together before, the battery would have had the characteristics of the atom's battery. Chemicals are chemicals. They work the same way every time if you have the same chemicals. But the fact of the matter is that there has never been a battery prior to atoms that had its characteristics. The atom's battery characteristics are opposite in most cases to every prior art battery. 140 years of battery research. This is the first different battery since Volta invented the battery in 1800. Secondly, the government says it's obvious, but when Adams took his battery a month after Pearl Harbor and went to Fort Monmouth, as he was directed to do, and displayed it to the assembled battery experts, including Dr. Fishback and Dr. Mandel, who later on filed their own patent on the same battery, they looked at the battery working in front of them with the steam coming out of it and told Adams, it can't work. That's the battery the government says is obvious. Now I'll put it in the water. Now I'm using warm water here, hopefully, so that this battery may activate before my 30 minutes are up. The government relies upon two additional references, the Niordet text and the Hayes patent. Both, well, I think Niordet was 1880 and Hayes is 1883. The Niordet text teaches the second water-activated battery. My brother Douglas is correct on this. And in the same text, if you read it, and you'll find it at page record 515, on the same or the next page, it says that the Niordet battery, which was actually the Marie Davy battery, did not work. And it didn't work until another scientist named De La Rue came along and put salts or salammoniac in the water, and then the battery worked. So the art had its understanding of battery theory reinforced by Niordet. You have to take all of the government's references put together. Because when you take the totality of the government's references in conjunction with the ones that Adams put in, you arrive at the inescapable conclusion that what the government and Adams combined to prove was that no one in the battery art believed that water could possibly function in a battery, Everybody in the battery art knew that you couldn't use magnesium in a battery, and that cuprous chloride had never been successfully used in any practical battery. And that's the totality of the government's art and ours. I don't know whether you can see that small light that I have there. It's only a 1.5-volt lamp. That's all that this battery will produce, this cell. What you say, Mr. Justice White, is quite correct. Bert Adams was not a scientist. He didn't know that what he was doing was impossible. He didn't know that the combination he put together was ridiculous. But as a matter of fact, to be fair to Adams, Adams is a natural genius. And he disbelieved these theories that I've been talking about. He said that magnesium is soluble in water. And he believed that cuprous chloride could be solubilized in water. And he believed that water could carry a conductive electrolyte in combination with the magnesium. And he is the only one who is right. So, untutored or not, he is a bona fide natural genius. And understand the conditions under which this man worked. He had no laboratory. He made his experimental batteries that he delivered to the army by the dozens on his kitchen stove. These were the people watching this untutored man come in, and you can understand why they had difficulty believing him. He just didn't look prepossessing. He didn't appear to be the type that you would think could be a great scientist. But the fact of the matter is that if you go back to battery science, you have to say that since Volta, there has been Edison, Adams. Now, the 18...
Did his battery actually work, the one he brought to the Army?
Oh, yes.
I thought somebody had to give him a little... had to improve it a little bit.
I beg pardon, Mr.
Did the one that he actually brought in work right then and there?
Oh, quite correct. That's proven by the article Dr. Fishback wrote in 1952, where he said, when we looked at this battery originally, we thought that because of its self-initiation and exothermic reaction, it was inoperative. But now we realize that those two characteristics give it two of its most important advantages. And that's why he filed his patent on it. And my brother Douglas finds fault with the claims of Adams. But if you read the claims of Fishback, you'll find that Fishback is claiming a battery with a magnesium anode and a cuprous chloride cathode with carbon in it. Except he said that my battery is porous. He didn't tell the United States Patent Office, which the Department of Justice sometimes excoriates, that the Adams patent taught how to make the cathode porous by the use of carbon. And the 1880 Neo-Adet reference, which has just been referred to, taught the exact method that Fishback used to make his electrode. So that the invention of Fishback is anticipated by the art that is cited by the government today. Yet the government has not disclaimed that patent. It is still viable. It could be asserted against anyone. Indeed, it could be asserted against Adams. Now, the third reference, the fourth reference, presently relied on by the government, is Codd. And the Codd textbook, I think, is the most devastating answer to the government's case. It's a textbook published in 1928. It's fairly extensive in three places, widely separated. It mentions, one, magnesium, and teaches that if you put magnesium into sulfuric acid opposed to copper, you can measure its electromotive force. Two other or three other references put in by the government teach that if you put magnesium in sulfuric acid, it will be destroyed in a matter of minutes. Other references put in by the government teach that no one knew how to use magnesium in a primary battery as of 1928. So it was perfectly obvious that what Codd was teaching was merely an electrical measurement method. It was not a battery. The second substance mentioned by Codd is silver chloride, 40 pages away from the mention of magnesium. The third thing mentioned by Codd is that the art was trying to make water-activated batteries, and it gave several examples. And these water-activated batteries were made by putting the salts, which you need to make the water conductive, into the interstices between the electrodes. Then you pour the water in, the salts are melted by the water, and the battery becomes conductive and operative. So there in Codd, mind you, is magnesium, silver chloride, and water. No one suggested that they could ever be put together. Todd didn't suggest it. The closest the government comes to anticipating atoms is to find that almost all of the substances used by atoms, which were cuprous chloride, magnesium, activate the battery with water, were combined in a book, not in a battery. 1928, 10 years before atoms. Now, actually, all of the references are distinguished because of the several references cited by my brother Douglas. He mentioned Jumau, and Jumau was a patent in 1937, just 2 years before atoms. And Jumau said, here is the way you make magnesium work in a battery. Jumau doesn't work. The testimony shows Adams' expert faithfully reproduced Jumau, tested it, it does not function. That's Jumau. The second one is that silver chloride is cited by the government, and they refer to the Hayes and Neodet patents. Now, at the trial, Adams insisted that cuprous chloride, which he disclosed in his patent, and silver chloride, which is not disclosed in his patent, but which he told the Army about in 1942, were equivalents. He said, they'll both work in my battery. We put in 8 requested findings of fact to the commissioner, requesting the commissioner to find that cuprous chloride and silver chloride were equivalents. The government opposed them all. The commissioner, in his decision, stated that he refused to find that cuprous chloride and silver chloride were equivalents. He therefore held that the government's procurement of silver chloride, magnesium, water-activated batteries was not an infringement. We acquiesced. The government took no exceptions. Now the government comes to you and says, in its petition for the reason for granting certiorari, cuprous chloride and silver chloride are equivalents, and you should reverse the commissioner because he didn't, in fact, find that. In other words, they ask you to reverse the commissioner on a finding of fact, or for failing to find, or for making a decision that they themselves induced the commissioner to make. And as you know, we have a motion pending on that. Now, to get to the point about the battery being unobvious, the reason the scientists couldn't believe the Adams battery when they saw it operating is because, in fact, it does not operate like any other battery. I have here a graph, which is a copy of Plaintiff's Exhibit 38, with the exception of the two legends. And this graph was made by a battery scientist at Fort Monmouth named Shore. Now, Shore was not one of the men that Adams talked to. Shore was a man who was given just simply a copy of the Adams patent and asked to do some experimentation. And the experimentation he did was to follow that patent and make several batteries. This is one of them. And if you see this curve, this flat line going out about 3/4 of the way across the graph, that is the curve of the battery he made following simply the instructions in the Adams patent. Now, he had some other duties that were not fully explained, but in any event, he took each of the elements in the Adams patent, such as magnesium, and he tried all kinds of other chlorides with it. And then he would take cuprous chloride and try all kinds of different metals with it. And then he experimented with different types of electrolytes. And he found out that the only combination that worked was the one that Adams taught. All the others were failures. At the same time, he ran some tests on 2 commercial Colesman's batteries, which at that time, and this is 1944, were being procured by the government for high-altitude meteorological research. And he plotted the curve of the voltage delivery of those 2 batteries. And here you see how they go down. Now, this is an experimental Adams battery built by a man who built 2 or 3 of them against the best commercial procurement of batteries that the government could manage in the middle of the war. Your Honors, this is the real prior art. This is what Scrivenoff, Hayes, Neodet, Todd, and all the rest of them taught the battery art. You couldn't make a battery that would give you any constant current on continuous surface. You couldn't make a battery that didn't show an early failure. This battery of Adams is the first battery that will give continuous power efficiently. Every other battery when you put it on continuous service, declined so fast that it reached the point of inoperativeness in a very short period of time. This is the first battery that will give level power like a generator. And practically every electrical device, radio sending or receiving set, whatever it may be, requires level electrical power to work efficiently. It cannot work efficiently on declining current. You get fading in radios and various other effects. The third thing about this battery, and the reason why the battery scientists at Fort Monmouth had so much trouble understanding how it could work, is that when Adams demonstrated it, and I don't think you can see it here, there's too much water, but the battery heats up, and as a matter of fact, it will boil. The water in the Adams battery will actually come to a boil. Steam will come out of it. Now, every prior art voltaic battery, when it began to heat up, was polarizing, losing power, and destroying itself. In the Adams battery, the heating reaction is a pure side reaction. It does not affect the level, continuous production of electrical power whatsoever. But because of the boiling phenomenon, the government felt, and these experts felt, that this was a battery that was running away and destroying itself. In fact, it is the boiling of the Adams battery that permits the battery to operate at minus 60 degrees below zero, almost 100 degrees below the freezing temperature of the water it's filled with. And this is the battery that has licked the age-old problem in the battery art of low temperature performance. There is no other battery that'll work well at 60 degrees below zero. There just isn't. And the Adams battery today is used by the government for more unusual and usual uses than any other battery. This battery, for example, is used in meteorological research. It's sent up to 100,000 feet in the stratosphere, where the temperature goes down to 60 degrees below zero, and this is the only battery that will work under those conditions effectively. Now, there were other reasons why the government experts could not believe that it worked. And these are reasons why the battery is not really obvious. You can't start this battery when you want to. It isn't like every one of the prior art batteries, which both experts at the trial called a bell ringer. When they push the button, the battery delivers current and the bell rings. When you take your finger off the button, it stops. The Adams battery won't do that. It takes a half hour to start the Adams battery after you put it together, unless you use special methods such as hot water to energize it rapidly. And if you don't do that, and another thing about the battery is that you can't stop it. I can take that bulb out and break the external circuit. That battery will go right on boiling and generating and using itself up. That's what the government experts call the self-destructive feature. The other thing about it, of course, is the fact that it boils over. And conventionally, all the experts knew that a battery that heated up was destroying itself. Now, we say that the government takes the position that the Adams battery is simply not new and simply obvious because it doesn't wish to address itself to the real question for which possibly this court granted certiorari. We feel that if you apply the test which were set forth in the A&P case and in CUNO and in Rayovac, and when I refer to the A&P case, I refer to both the majority and the concurring opinions, we feel that when you apply the facts of record to those criteria, you'll find that Adams meets the criteria of A&P completely. For example, in A&P it was stated that as a result of the combination, there had to be something unusual. The whole had to be greater than the sum of the parts. Now, what does that mean? Suppose in a battery that the whole were just equal to the sum of the parts. You used a better anode, a better cathode, possibly energized it in some better way, you would get a better conventional battery. These curves might have come out a little further, but it would still be a bell ringer. It would still give you only intermittent as opposed to continuous power. It would still give you only declining power as opposed to level power, and it wouldn't work well at low temperatures. In the Adams battery, you put together an anode and a cathode, and what do you get? You get a battery that's not like any other battery. Indeed, it's more like a heat engine than a battery.
and it develops power in a way that is not like a battery, but indeed is like a generator. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. The second point made, I believe, in A&P was that it is necessary that the useful arts, in majority opinion, or the particular science involved, had to be greatly advanced. In this case, it would be the science of electrochemistry. I don't think the government disputes that the science of electrochemistry has been greatly advanced by atoms. Here we have the first unexplained experimental results since Volta. The voltaic theory no longer fits all observed experimental phenomena in the battery field. The next point is...
Are these results still unexplained?
Yes, Your Honor. No one really understands this. There are three things that are unexplained about the atom's battery. First of all, no one understands why this combination does generate current. Secondly, no one understands why this delivery curve of voltage remains level. This is a primary battery. You put the parts in it with all the electrical energy when you put it together. And then as it grows older and is used, there's less and less material, and you would expect, and indeed all prior art batteries, decline as you have less material, less magnesium, whatever it may be, working in the battery. This does not, and no one can understand why it doesn't go down. Almost every curve that you see in nature, our natural phenomenon, has a curve to it. That's why they're called curves. This is the first straight line curve. And when it comes to the end of its life, it falls right off the cliff. This peculiar little zigzag in this graph is due to the fact that Mr. Shore let his battery run out of water. So he put some more in it, came back to life, then declined.
So to this day, these phenomena that you've described are unexplained in the area of electrochemistry or whatever it's called?
That's correct. That's correct. Mr. Pucher?
Is it still accepted that magnesium is not soluble in water?
Yes. Yes. Magnesium is not soluble in water to any substantial degree. I might say that magnesium is soluble in boiling water. So I suppose if you want to make a battery out of magnesium, all you have to do is create one that'll boil. And if that's the answer, this is the only boiling battery. That's true, though. The second point, or the last point, and this particularly applied to the concurring opinion in A&P, was a requirement that masters in the field of electrochemistry should have recognized the contribution to be an important scientific advance. And in that connection, I would like to just mention briefly what the masters in the field of electrochemistry have said about the atom's battery. Dr. Fishback, magnesium Cooper's chloride batteries have obtained considerable importance, particularly as meteorological batteries. Dr. Chubb, in 1952, the exact nature of the complex chemical current-producing reactions of this type of cell is not known in any substantial detail. Morse, the water-activated battery systems are among the relatively new power sources which have become extremely important to the military during the past decade. Morse, the definite trend to water-activated batteries for high-altitude and seawater applications indicates they are unsurpassed as one-shot power packs for low-temperature use and for underwater operations. Morse, there can be no doubt that the addition of water-activated batteries to the family of power sources has brought about developments which would otherwise have been technically or economically impractical. Recognition by outstanding experts in the field of electrochemistry that this untutored, simple man has made an important advance in the science of electrochemistry. And I think the requirements that this court enunciated in A&P for invention have been fully met by Adams. And beyond that, I think the statement in Cuno has been met. I think this is surely a work of creative genius, not merely the skill of the court. Thank you.
If the court please, so far as constant current is concerned, that had been suggested in a number of prior references, Wenske, Nyode, Hayes, and Jumeau, all contained in the record, and the suggestion in those prior references was that a metallic chloride would do the trick. When this battery was taken up to Fort Monmouth, difficulty was that it boiled over. And that's what put the Army scientists off. But I think the significant point about my distinguished opponent's argument is that it was devoted almost entirely to results. There was no detailed effort to justify the scientific advance in terms of the prior art, except to say that one was operable and the other wasn't, and that something else achieved certain results, whereas others had not. Even if what he said was absolutely correct, this would still not establish patentability, because the test under Section 103 is, had this been apparent to someone skilled in the field in the prior art? And there's no finding that there was any such search in this case, and in fact, a comparison of the Skrivenoff and Adams patents show that they're virtually congruent. And for these two reasons, we believe that patentability should not be sustained.